read together, please, in the book of Numbers and chapter 6, the sixth chapter of the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers, chapter 6 and verse 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite to separate themselves unto the Lord, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink, and shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink. Neither shall he drink any liqueur of grapes, nor eat moist grapes or dried. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husk. All the days of the vow of his separation, there shall no razor come upon his head, until the days be fulfilled in which he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall be holy, and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. All the days that he separateth himself unto the Lord, he shall come at no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, or for his mother, for his brother, or for his sister when they die, because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation he is holy unto the Lord. And if any man die very suddenly by him, and he hath defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day shall he shave it. And on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and make an atonement for him for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. And he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of his separation, and shall bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering. But the days that were before shall be lost, because his separation was defiled. And this is the law of the Nazarite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. He shall be brought unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall offer his offering unto the Lord, one he lamb of the first year without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb of the first year without blemish for a sin offering, and one ram without blemish for peace offerings, and a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, and wafers of unleavened bread anointed with oil, and their meat offering and their drink offering. And the priest shall bring them before the Lord, and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Lord with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also his meat offering and his drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And he shall take the hair of the head of his separation and put it in the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall take the sodden shoulder of the ram and one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them upon the hands of the Nazarite after the hair of his separation is shaven. And the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. This is holy for the priest, with the wave breast and the heave shoulder. And after that the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite who hath vowed, and of his offering unto the Lord for his separation, besides that that his hand shall get, according to the vow which he vowed, so must he do after the law of his separation. And we trust that the Lord will bless to us this reading of his holy and inspired word. The institution of the vow of the Nazarite brings us to what, for me at least, is one of the most precious enactments of the entire Mosaic economy. It seems to me that in a particular way, and in a unique sense, that this vow breathes the very spirit of New Testament revelation. Now, it wouldn't be possible for me to express in one meeting all that is in this passage. Likely I haven't grasped it all anyway. And even so, I couldn't tell you all that I have in my heart to say to you about this great subject of the vow of the Nazarite. But we'll try and gather a few simple things under three little headings. I want to speak to you this afternoon about the motive of the Israelites, and then something of the mode or the manner of the way in which the vow was kept, and then finally, it wouldn't be of any value unless we tried to say something about the meaning of the vow of the Nazarite. It seems to me remarkable that in the instruction given in relation to this vow, there is nothing said, not even a slight hint given, as to the kind of circumstances that might arise in the heart of the Israelites that would cause such a desire to be begotten, that he should vow in this way unto the Lord. Not only remarkable, but I think it is most suggestive. This is underlined for us when we remember, or perhaps when we reflect, that in the whole of the Old Testament scripture, and the New come to that, there is not a single instance given to us, there's not a single person referred to who has taken upon himself the vow according to the instructions of this chapter. I know that Samson was a Nazarite, but that vow was taken for him before he was born. Some have felt that Samuel and John the Baptist were Nazarites. I wouldn't complain about that. But in each of these two instances as well, it was something that was upon them from the very womb. And I say to you this evening, it is a matter of great interest that God has not provided us at all with a single character who has responded in the way of his appointment here and taken upon himself the vow of the Nazarite. We are not to suppose, of course, that there were no such men. Amos chapter 2 and verse 11 would disabuse us of any notions of that nature. Says Jehovah, I raise up of your sons for priests and of your young men for Nazarites. And then we think too of that great prophet. For myself, the most beloved of all the prophets, the great man Jeremiah in his lamentations. Oh, he says, her Nazarites were pure as snow, white as milk, more ruddy of body than rubies, and their polishing was of sapphire. So there were those who responded in this remarkable way. But God has given us no example. He has given us no hint as to what it was that motivated these dear Israelites to consecrate themselves thus. I think it's appropriate. I think it's most suggestive. My dear fellow saints, I want to say this, that the motive for consecration is personal. It's absolutely individual. And at no stage was the Nazarite obligated to declare his reason for taking the vow upon him. It was personal. I think we can see something of the motive, and I do want to come to this, supposing the rest of what I have in my soul to say to you runs beyond the clock. I shan't run beyond it. But I do want us to see a motive of this dear man, and I believe it is enshrined in the first occurrence of the word separate in verse 2. When either man or woman shall separate. That's a different word from the one at the close of the verse. Separate in our English version, again, but a very different and distinct word. And I think if you take your strong concordance, those of you who are blessed with such a priceless treasure, you will find that God anticipated that in the experiences of his people, there would arise circumstances in which his child would desire in a special, in a unique, in a distinct and distinguishing way to express his devotion to his God. The possible circumstances, as I have said, are altogether hidden. But it seems from this particular word that the Israelites have scanned the whole provision of burnt offering and meal offering and peace offering.
And altogether they are inadequate to express the movement of his soul towards his God. And he is looking for some unique way, some distinct way, some distinguishing way of manifesting not to the eyes of Israel, but to manifesting to the soul of his blessed God in heaven. He's looking for a way of expressing his deep devotion to his God. I don't know how you feel as you think of that. God anticipating such deep spiritual movements in his people of Old Testament times. They lived under the diminutive light of the law. It was a shadow, only a shadow of the good things that were coming on. Could not, says the writer to the Hebrews, make the comers thereunto perfect. Their consciences were never purged from sin. The sacrifices that they offered, says Hebrews, could never take away sin. And yet with all the limitations of the revelation, God still anticipated that in the souls of his people betimes, there would be begotten these strong yearnings after an expression of devotion, which none of the offerings satisfied. I don't know how you feel about that. I feel tremendously humbled. I want to ask you, I ask my own soul, has there ever been begotten in this wretched heart of mine yearnings like that in relation to devotion? Isn't it passing strange? Isn't it more than peculiar that in the contemplative meditation of Christ, in all his heavenly grace and glory, and in the vastness of the work, in its inscrutable fullness accomplished at Calvary. Isn't it amazing that we can meditate upon that blessed Holy One, and in these souls of ours they are never to arise Nazarite desire. Isn't it strange? To think of the heavenly grace of that one who, though he were rich, yet for your sake, oh my dear fellow saint, will you forget the world just for a minute? And will you forget the church for a moment? Let this dawn afresh upon an illuminated soul. That he that was rich for your sake became poor. What a word. The word means as poor as a beggar. Oh, he wasn't a beggar. Never. But he became as poor as a beggar, that we, through his poverty, might be enriched. I want to ask you, as you think upon that glorious, that blessed, that transcendent, that Holy One, in all that he suffered on your account upon the cross, I ask you, are there no motives anywhere in the soul that cause her to reach out after an expression of devotion that his heart alone can understand and his heart alone appreciate? Oh yes, God appreciated the Nazarite vow. We only quoted Lamentations 4 and 7. Let's remind our souls of what we said. Her Nazarites were purer than the snow, white as milk, more ruddy of body than rubies, polishing of sapphire stone. What's God by his prophet describing, dear fellow saints? He's describing their beauty. God appreciates that. Beauty. Oh, we reach after beauty, don't we? I wonder if we're interested in spiritual beauty. Not without reason that the psalmist speaks of the beauty of holiness, is it? Did you ever realize that the sun,
that the acme, that the highest point of beauty is holiness?
Holiness, the beauty of holiness. The beauty. Oh, God appreciated this Nazarite vow. He did. Says he in Amos, we quote it again,
I raise up of your young men for Nazarite. Such was his earnest desire. Such was his great appreciation and love for these supreme expressions of devotion. That by his spirit he moved within. Raise up.
Nazarite. The Lotus. I ask myself again, is there no motive that I can find in my soul that begets in me a desire and a willingness to express in this singular, unique, distinct, distinguishing way my devotion for the one who has done so much for us? His motive. I want to look for a moment or two at the manner, the mode of his vow. I think we must say three things about what the vow was not. First of all,
it wasn't a vow to love the Lord more perfectly.
Wasn't that?
Remember the requirement of the law expressed by our Lord Jesus Christ. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, with all thy mind.
You never could love more than that, dear fellow saint. Never.
and that was the bounden beauty
of every Israelite.
It wasn't a vow to love the Lord more perfectly. It wasn't a vow to keep the law more sincerely. For every sin and trespass, albeit committed in ignorance, when it came to the consciousness of his mind, the Israelite was obligated to offer a sin or a trespass offering. That was obligatory to fulfill the whole law. Was his specified requirement. It wasn't a vow to keep the law more perfectly. It wasn't a vow to separate himself from sin. Wasn't that? So somebody, well, what is it then? I said to you at the start that this was a unique, that this was a distinct, that this was a distinguishing expression of devotion. And how is it going to be expressed? It's going to be expressed in the relinquishing, in the foregoing, in the abandonment of things which in the life of others are quite legitimate. There was no prohibition on partaking of the vine tree in any of its forms to the most of Israel. There was no prohibition in relation to his hair on the majority of Israel. But these things which were perfectly legitimate, they were not sin. They were not sinful. But these things, things that others could legitimately involve themselves in, these things were freely and willingly and scrupulously and energetically laid aside. Why? In order that he might express with God the devotion of his soul. I want to say that in the scrupulousness, in the stringency of the demands laid upon him, we have the safeguard against hypocrisy. You couldn't take this up lightly, you know. That separated period of time must be fulfilled in all its perfection and in all its completeness. And if it should happen that in the course of those days his head was defiled, he must start again. There was no opting out of this. I want you to see that he couldn't opt out for his mother, nor for his father, nor for his brother, nor for his sister. Once taken upon himself, and of course he would have nothing else. He would fulfill it unblemished.
complete. A perfect path for those prescribed number of days. I want you to see now the totality of his separation. It's not simply the intoxicating wine that he must lay aside. We might find some reason in our thinking to account for that. But everything, from the kernel, in our own language, from the pit to the skin, must be set aside. I can't think, you know, that these enactments of this law, while they were physical and material for the Israelites in a sense, I can't but think that even for the Israelites there was a symbolical significance. And what do we have here? Wine, I suppose, is universally accepted as being symbolic of joy. And here is one who, for this prescribed period of time, will in this sublime way acknowledge that all his rest, all his pleasure, all his joy, all his satisfaction, all his delight, all his pleasure is found exclusively in his blessed God. Tell me, did you not sing that 20 minutes ago? Take my life. All very well to sing it in a conference meeting. I want to ask you, have you waited at your bedside on your knees and handed the reins, the whole life over to Christ? Have you? You wouldn't sing a lie, would you? Take my life. Take my silver. Take my gold. Not a mite would I withhold. You're thinking about the widow woman that cast in the two mites. It was all her living. Not just what she had in her purse at the meeting, you know. And a bank book lying at home with £2,000, £3,000, £4,000 laid up on her. No. Could you honestly bow in the presence of God and tell him that all your joy, all your rest, all your pleasure, who on earth am I but thee? Who in heaven but thee? Have you, Nazarite, desires and exercises set aside? From the pit to the sketch. Everything that ministers joy and pleasure and delight to those in an outside world who have no Christ to satisfy their soul. I'm not talking about sinful things. Talking about all those things that have a legitimate place in the lives of others. I want to ask you, have you a devotion to Christ that will enable you to set it all aside and to say quietly in the presence of God, Thou, O Christ, art all I want. All very well to talk or to sing about that widow on the lonely garret floor, you know, that she, I have Christ. What want I more? It's another thing. In soul's experience to say to Christ, I have done with all below. My joy is found alone. But he wasn't to cut his hair, you know. It doesn't simply mean that he wasn't to shave it. All I know, it says the razor. But it says he must let the locks of the hair of his head grow. What do you think that means? You know, I'm satisfied that this portion requires to be interpreted in the light of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. I'm satisfied about that. In that passage, and we must say a little about it, in order to catch what God is expressing here. In that passage, Paul is not introducing something new that related to the Christian era in relation to the way we keep our hair. He wasn't doing that. In fact, hair is not the main subject of the passage. He's dealing with the glorious truth of headship. But not only the truth of headship, but the manifestation of headship. And in the establishment of the necessity for a sister covering her head in spiritual exercises and the brother uncovering his head, he appeals to the time-honored significance that God had always placed upon the hair. He appeals to that. And he says, God gave it for a covering. For a covering. And when headship is acknowledged, it is a glory. And when the mind of God is not endorsed, it's a shame. So it's not a matter of appearance, or what looks nice, or what suits us. It's a matter of, am I prepared to endorse? To acquiesce God's creatorial order and to express the headship that he has introduced according to his mind and his will. It is a matter of glory and shame.
Shame. In Philippians 3, Paul is speaking, I believe, about unconverted people. He says they are enemies of the cross of Christ. And one of the things he says about them is this: they glory in their shame. In other words, those things in their life that ought to beget in their souls feelings of deepest shame are things about which they boast and in which they glory. But then you see, they are not enlightened. They are not in possession of the mind of God. Tell me, isn't it a pity? Isn't it more than a pity that those who have come under the saving power of Christ have so allowed their minds to be influenced by the thinking of a world outside that they now glory in their shame? It's a shame. It is a shame. And the Nazarite knew that. That pole head of his symbolized the image and glory of God in whose likeness he stood. It was the very dignity of manhood. And in devotion to his God, he'll wear that which speaks of his submission and his subjection to all the will of God, until at last the period, the days, are fulfilled. Isn't it strange that we are so prone to stand upon our dignity, when the New Testament way, when the scriptural way, when the way of Christ is to allow our sweet yieldingness to be known to all, in view of the fact that the Lord is at hand? Oh, the strife, oh, the unrest from which we would have been delivered if we had been separated in Nazarite-ship to the one who loved us and gave himself for us. One minute. That'll leave Harry time to close the meeting respectively. He wasn't to come near a dead body. No, not for his father, nor for his mother, nor for his brother, nor for his sister, not for his dearest tie on earth. His first responsibility was his sanctification, his consecration, his vow that he had taken to his God.
What do you let interfere with your sanctification? Would you let your wife interfere with it? Or your husband? Would you let your boy interfere with it? Overseeing father? Would you let your lassie do it? Overseer's wife? Oh, the totality. The scrupulousness. The energy with which he would pursue that sanctification to his God until the days were fulfilled. Our days will be fulfilled when he steps into the air, and when at last, in all the fullness of the work of Christ at Calvary, we stand arrayed before him. The days of our separation shall be fulfilled, and we'll drink wine in the kingdom of God. May God bless you.